Accession number 32064.
Alexander Campbell, Reel 3. I'm sorry, I missed out your mother's maiden name again.
Macrobie.
Alexander Macrobie Campbell, Reel 3. And so you went to Bermuda, and where did you go
then
next?
Then from there we got the job of escorting six ships that had been taken over by the Russians, smaller ships, and we were to escort them back to the United Kingdom, to Ireland. And we, on the way along, one of these ships developed problems, so we had to request permission to go into the Azores. So we signalled that, and when we went in there, of course, the mayor was on the jetty a lot, because by that time they'd seen Russian flags flying, and Portugal wasn't friendly with Russia. So we were given 24 hours to do what we wanted to do and get off. And that's the only place I've ever seen. When we made fast there, you had to have a diver, because the securities was on the bottom of the harbour, and they took your anchor chain and connected it up to the bottom of the harbour. You need a diver to do that. Come on. So you could never leave without paying your bill on that piece. most unusual all the time. So we're 24 hours there, and apart from going to a conference the next day, to the next part of the journey with the Russian captains to see what was uneventful. And then we got back to London, Delhi. Then we were... They had an American commander on board the ship as a sort of interpreter. He spoke Russian, he was there. Had to go.
And so when... Can you remember roughly when you were back in Londonderry? Beginning of 44, something like that?
Oh, it'd be in 44, yes. It'd be in the early part of 44. Because I'm trying to relate that to our next job was down to the invasion. So that was June, so must have been March or April.
Okay. So March or April 44, and you're back in Londonderry.
Yeah.
What happens next?
We must have gone to sea and done things, but I've no particular recollection other than probably in May we went up the west coast of Scotland to practice sweeping an area exactly, which was the replica of what we were going to do at Normandy invasion. We didn't know that time, of course. We were just doing this back and forward day in, day out.
Can you just describe the process of sweeping for me?
Well, the sweeping is you throw out your sweeps overboard and you sweep an area. And the idea, the ships do it in a staggered formation. In theory, the only ship that should be in unswept water is the leading ship. That's the senior officer. And as they sweep, we have down layers falling on behind who drop flags, which with their weight on them, into the water. So that gave you a line of down flags to follow down. When you turned at one end, you come back down and got that up and down, which meant you were always in swept water. That was the theory.
Did you say what sort of flags?
A down flag. It's just, you know, a flag on a pole and a weight. And that's what you're to look for when you're sweeping, is to you to steam the next leg down that. And picking up flag in the sunlight, quite business. And the idea was to get as close to the flag as possible without actually getting your sweep caught up in it, because the tide's working there as well. And do that back and forward.
And can you just describe the sweeps for me? What do the sweeps look like?
Well, a sweep looked like a five-bar gate in metal, which you connected up, and it was connected from one end of it to what looked like a torpedo, and it had a flag on it, and the other part was attached to the winch, which is back on board the ship. So when you put your sweep over the side, it was to a specific depth. You determined how deep you wanted the sweep, shallow or deep or otherwise, and the sweep would immediately sweep out the side, and you follow the flag on the damper. So the ship coming on behind always made sure it stayed inside the dan flag, on the sweep, so that it was a sweat water, and they all did that down the line, eight ships in the line.
And could you see a mine from above the water? Were there any giveaway signs?
Well, the only giveaway signs would be the flag, a little flag, but you'd be very good at it to pick that up.
And what sort of damage could a mine do if a
sink ship? Oh yeah, because I mean a mine is a load of explosives with horns on it, and if any of these horns catches the ship, it explodes it up. So that's a big factor.
Mm-hmm. So you went and did that. You did that exercise up off the coast of Scotland.
Yes.
And what came next?
The next thing we were sent off to Normandy, as it turned out to be. Then we were told we were going.
So when were you told?
When we were at sea. Well, of course, we were intending to do the invasion on the 5th of June, as you know. And that, of course, was when I had to do my about turn. And this fellow said, sorry. Because we'd gone so far down, then to go and waste 24 hours, the whole fleet turned round and come back again. And manoeuvring ships, that was a moment.
And did you have any idea what you might be doing?
Oh, then we went in, and we had the job of sweeping the second cruiser squadron in, who were going to do the bombarding to enable the invasion to take place. So we were there quite early in the morning doing this, and ironically, we never got one mine. You just wouldn't believe that the Germans were so complacent and think it couldn't happen there. I said, for all our practice, we never needed it. And when dawn was breaking and we were targets on the horizon, we got a little bit anxious. And then the cruisers came along out there. And then we were allocated to the Frobisher. Each cruiser got a minesweeper to precede it, wherever it went. It was always in sweat water, and we had the job of making sure they were there. So we had a grandstand view of all that happened on D-Day. Ships being blown up, troops going ashore, parachutists going in.
Were you on deck? You were.
Oh yeah.
You were at your gun station.
We were all at action station. The ironic factor there: we were told to wear our uniform because we're going to be so close to enemy. We had to create the right impression. So we officers had our uniform on. Were allocated a revolver and morphine. So if anyone's injured, you'd be able to administer. Happily, none of that was required, but that was the theory that was behind it at the time.
So tell me what you saw. Can you talk me through it sort of stage by stage?
No, it was one of these occasions when there was so much happening, it was impossible to remember. You just remember the picture of ships being blown up, of parachutists dropping in, landing craft going ashore, dropping. Tremendous.
So, and how long were you there for, do you think, roughly?
Well, we were there for a month on the basis that once the invasion was underway, we then formed what they called the trout line, with ships lying protected on the coast. And you started at one end and did 2 days and moved down at the line. And when you got to the far end, you then went back to the Isle of Wight to restore bits and pieces. And that's what we did. And then we came back from the Isle of Wight. And on the 6th of July, exactly a month afterwards, we were sunk by one of these human torpedoes.
And just before we get onto that, can you just tell me what were you doing on the trout? You said the trout line, you would start at one end. What were you doing in the trout?
Well, we were sweeping during the day. That was one of the other aspects, because we would sweep channels too, because merchant ships were going in all the time and we were sweeping channels. And then after not very long, ships started to be sunk. So the finger was immediately pointed, you haven't done your job right. But then fortunately some clever boffin quickly discovered that they had laid what they call oyster mines, which were laid on the seabed, which were only detonated by the pressure. So we, as a minesweeper, could swim with it and make no difference. A 10,000-ton merchant ship would come along, and the pressure of that blew it up. So then they took one of these concrete blocks, which they used for the Mulberry Harbour. A tug would tow that across. We would sweep a channel, and the tug would come across us behind it. So that way they could guarantee the swept channel for the merchants. That was your daily job, sweeping back and forward, the tug, ting, ting.
And you said you resupplied on the Isle of Wight?
Yes.
What was the supply base like there?
I have no idea. It was very pleasant. To be back in civilization, went ashore and had a water, had a cup of tea. It was just, you know, very nice.
And did you have much sense of how the invasion was going?
I think by that time we were well aware that it was going quite well. And as much as I never been repelled.
Okay. And so tell me about the day you were sunk. Tell me about the day you were sunk.
Well, I remember I was in my cabin sleeping. It was in the middle watch when it happened. And this mighty explosion. And I immediately got up to get out. And the furniture in the wardroom was all over the place. And I had to go through the wardroom to get out the door to get there. And that's when I'm ever so grateful for luminous clocks. Because when the luminous clock in the bulkhead above the door, and I aimed for that, and out I went up an upper deck. Great kerfuffle when people were abandoning ship. So over the side I went and swam in the water a bit and caught up in a Carly float. Checking up who else was there.
Sorry, caught up on a?
A Carly float, which is the ships have to, for emergencies like that. You can sit and hang on there, will keep you afloat. I mean, take what, a dozen people or more of them. As an officer, I was checking up whether I was going to be in charge of this. Discovered one of my fellow officers, a lieutenant, he was there. So he was in charge, so that was all out.
And so what happened? So
and then after that, unfortunately, some of the ship's company were picked up by another ship in the line, which was sunk 20 minutes later. So these poor people had to be rescued twice in one night.
And just tell me what it was like. Tell me what the experience was like, just realising what happened, realising you were going to have to jump overboard.
You hadn't time to think. You just had to get on and do it. I mean, that was the last thing. The realisation afterwards when you discovered that three of your colleagues hadn't made it is another matter. 27 men and 3 officers died that night. And then we steamed back to Portsmouth and were kitted out in Portsmouth with battle dress and the like so that sufficient to take us on and sent on survivor's leave. And I also remember going home the Sunday morning and my mother and father were quite happy because I had a letter from me the day before. Then, of course, when you realise that to see you in the flesh, there isn't any problem. Had they been told about it, it would have been pretty grim. So that was that.
Yeah. So how long were you on leave for?
Almost a month, actually. Strange, I missed a bit in my life when I was in London there, after we came back from America. I was walking down the high street, whatever street it was, and bumped into my friend of yesteryear, who had shared the cloakroom duties with me. He was a pilot based there. So, needless to say, he said, come aboard the ship, have a few drinks, and we had a good few drinks that night. And he said the next day, well, you must come out to the airbase and have a flight. So I went out there and was taken into his Swordfish, there's 3 of them in the Swordfish, so one was left ashore, a butler and the guy, and I went into like the navigator seat. And I remember coming back and saying, well, if that's flying, let me get back to sea, because they were practicing, 120 knots they were flying, they were practicing going on and then zoomed down as if they were attacking a submarine. I did not like it one bit, so, strange enough, I was supposed to be that lad's best man, and his intended wife had been an early girlfriend of mine, because we were all at school together, but I was posted to America 2 days beforehand, and he got married on August the 12th, so it was, but that's where I was there from July, about a month, you see, there, he didn't know how long you were going to be there, so that was the thing.
So, to take you forward again, so you were on survivor's leave.
Yeah.
So when was that? So.
Well, from August? I arrived on the 9th of July.
9th of July.
Because the only good thing came out of being sunk is I met my wife.
How did you manage that?
On the next day, the 10th of July, I went into the local Paradidons, where everyone would go to see who was there and, you know, meet. She had arranged to meet somebody who sent a telegram to say they couldn't come, he was flying or something that day. So I met her. So we had the stairs. So we got on quite well. We didn't sit down. Then we took it out for the meal. Then from the meal we went along to the cinema, saw Gone with the Wind. Then walked at the bus station and put her on the bus. Well, she was a wren at Rosyth, so she was working in between times. So, but every time she was free or could come across at night time, we were out. So that went on for the month. So by the time I had left, I had a very good relationship. But having seen three of my colleagues found her, the last thing I would be thinking of is making any proposal for a girl, which is in a difficult spot. So I went away for 2 years after that, and when I came back, phoned her up, she was still there. The rest is history now.
So tell me, so at the end of that month, at the end of your lovely month, what happened next?
I was off to America went off to Canada to join the ship. So we went to New York and then got the train up from New York to Newfoundland. And I travelled with the captain of that ship, whose name I cannot remember. It's troubled me. He was Lieutenant Commander R&R. Stocky little fellow, good companion. So we picked up the ship there. It had come down from Toronto. The first lieutenant brought her down there, and he took over and brought us back to the UK. And when we got back to the UK, we got our posting to go to the Mediterranean. And the captain says, "Well, I'm not where we're going." He'd had three overseas postings already. True to his word, the ambulance was summoned in the morning. He said, "Lady, she was seen in the upper deck with no clothes on, in a very high temperature, etc., and taken off the hospital immediately." So again, we sailed under the first lieutenant down to London, where we picked up another lieutenant commander who took over the ship. What happened to him, I do not know, but he certainly, true to his word, he wasn't going back again. He felt he was entitled after three overseas postings to have some time at home.
And just remind me of the name of this ship.
That was the Coquette.
And so that was presumably August 44. August 44, you started at the Coquette.
I would imagine so, yes. Yes, probably the end of August, that's right, yeah.
And so you set sail, so what happened?
We went down to the Mediterranean, stopped at Gibraltar, and then went into Mediterranean and sweeping a base on the Italian coast. Because we, from Malta, we moved up to Taranto, and we'd be based there, and sweeping mines up and down, back and forward.
And was there anything memorable about that trip?
Not really. It was just sort of pretty routine. Because mine sweeping is a sort of boring sort of job. It's a sort of full of inactivity, and then every now and again activity. Because if you've got a mine, then the people in the Dan ships generally, and yourself too, would use a rifle to try and explode it. The problems arose if you're swimming along the channel. If a mine popped up just ahead of you, you had to be pretty sharp to move your ship out of the way. And of course, if that did happen, that immediately caused a dogleg, you know, out the way in the sweeping area, so that through the line you had to correct that from the next layer. So
and
we were fifth ship in the line, so in theory we were always in straight water.
And when you were trying to deal with a mine with a rifle, were you trying to hit anywhere in particular?
As long as you hit it, it could explode it, really. And mighty bang, and that was okay, you know.
And how big were the mines?
Oh, great big thing.
So it's about 3 feet. 3 feet across.
I think so, yeah.
Okay. So you had lots of mine sweeping on the Coquette.
Oh, yeah, that was our job. And as I say, we were fifth ship in the line until our senior officer got sunk at Corfu, the ship was sunk there. There were shipping mines off Corfu, and only one person was killed on that occasion, fortunately. And because of that, we became senior officer. Our captain, first lieutenant, and navigator were whipped off, like they were sent back home, and we inherited the commander and his navigating officer and first lieutenant on our ship. So we immediately moved from fifth and out to the leading ship and the like. So we became senior officer, a black band round our funnel to distinguish us. So life changed in that way.
How did that change things when you were doing the operation?
Well, you were the first ship in the line, also. Any unswept water, you were the only ones going to be there. One thing we did learn on our previous commander was he always insisted that we would bring the ship alongside, we young officers, anchor to a buoy, we would do it. And if anything went wrong, and the senior officer would name the officer of the watch, he always sent his name back. He never put you in trouble.
Well, so can you remember his name?
Bud Abbott. He was a great chap because he was a merchant seaman. He was supposed to have been a professional dancer at one stage with Victor Sylvester, because we used to have a lot of fun. When we'd go to the officers' club, he'd go and dance with the nurses and the girls and bring them back and line up four or five of them for a party the next night and board a ship. And but you had to be a heel-lit gentleman. No nonsense. And I got the nickname of Coquette's Romeo because I got the job of going in the boat to go and pick the girls up from ashore and bring them to the ship. And I remember one night when all boat traffic was suspended in Malta, off you go. Had there been a problem, he would have been in trouble. But I went ashore and a very good Newfoundland who was a coxswain, he handled the boat. I had all I had to do there was to be there. I wasn't doing anything. Brought them, and the time it came to going ashore at night time, it was like a mill pond and all flattened out, but it was pretty tricky earlier on. So that made an adventurous life. But when we became senior officer, then learnt that how our captain's response as officer of the watch, they knew it wasn't him, and they just accepted it. Because he could tie a ship with a lamppost, quite honestly. Really wonderful ship handlers.
Why was he so good? Or what made
because
him so good?
In the Merchant Navy, they have minimum number of people and they have to put a ship alongside before they throw the lines out. If we would go back to when I was a sailor in Gibraltar, if it was a rough night, we had a captain who would have to use a coasting gun line, which is firing a line ashore, so they could attach the wire to get alongside. And for a destroyer, a captain to do that, it's a disgrace. When he was superseded by Maitland McGill Crichton, now he was the different, he was a destroyer man, he would roll a steam flat and put on the brakes and stop them. Everything was wonderful. And he would have this, would have exercises on board the ship, do leapfrogs, have everybody off the bridge, he'd be in charge, participating. It made everyone alive. And you knew what you were doing there, it kept everyone going.
Sorry, so just remember his name, he was Maitland.
That was when I was in 42, when I was a seaman.
Yeah.
And the Venomous.
His name was Maitland McCrichton Smith, was it?
Maitland McGill Crichton.
McGill Crichton, sorry.
And he had tattoos on his arms, so obviously the proper naval families, because some of them these days would have tattoos, etc.
And tell me a little bit more, you said about leapfrog, was it?
Yeah, and you'd be very careful, otherwise you'd go over the side of the ship. No, he had to do an exercise and game. He'd have a treasure hunt. Look for a piece of bacon in his skin, in the shape of an ox. All odd items that go down the ship. And everybody going to keep them occupied. Broke the monotony.
And that was officers as well, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. He chased them off the bridge. He was in charge on the bridge, full stop. You go and do what you're supposed to do.
And can you just describe him? What sort of man was he?
Well, he's a tall, slim man, actually. Mm-hmm. Probably about 5'8".
Okay.
Yeah, fine.
So you were just describing him for me?
Well, yes. All I remember most about him was his behaviour pattern, and as much as he was a friend. I mean, he wasn't aloof. He would talk, if you walked in the upper deck and you were there, they would speak to you, say something, you were a human being. Whereas the other one was very detached. And very detached with the wardroom too. They didn't have the same relationship.
Okay, so to take you back to the coquette.
Yes.
Where did we get up to? So you were mind sweeping.
Yeah.
Yes. And how long did you do that for?
Well, my naval career.
But how long were you on the coquette for?
Until I left her in 1946. We moved from the Mediterranean out to Hong Kong and went up there in Hong Kong, and then we swept mines with the Americans off the Chinese coast, Amoy there, and that was a different way of working. They covered their area by radar. We were painstaking particulars for flagging. So, okay, there were no problems, but it was a very different way of working. Then so after a spell there, we came back to Mediterranean.
So how would they do it?
By checking the area by radar that they'd all been swept. Whereas the navigating officer would pinpoint a chart carefully of the area we'd set and going on, so the whole area was clearly established what had been swept, and you knew it had been swept properly. But the Americans, well, they would do much, much, much more of the day than we would do. And that was that. And that's where life was different when we went out there.
Why was that?
Well, you went into Hong Kong. I have to remember first going into Hong Kong, and the junks would cut across your bow. And captain said, "Don't worry, don't get out of the way. They want to be as close to you as possible so you can cut off the evil spirit that's following them." And this is what was done. But I mean, for a young officer, the thought of perhaps going to hit a junk coming in, no. And of course, when you got there, one of these junks lined itself up with you, and they were your service point. They cared for you, for the privilege of us giving us the garbage from the kitchen, of which they lived happily. They would do our washing for us, a lot, everything. And they would be on the quayside. When we would come back into harbour, the word would get round, we're coming back, they'd be there waiting for you. Wonderful.
And did you go into town?
Then went into Hong Kong. I also remember the fact that, I think, probably helped me think I don't like Chinese food, on the basis that I remember seeing a young boy walking along the road with a string of bacon on the end of a string, pulling along the pavement. I thought, oh my God. And then, of course, if we went to the odd place where Chinese food was served up, dish and grease, not for me. No. I don't like gravy in any event, so that was a starting point for not liking it. So Chinese food never did anything for me.